May it please the court, this is a products liability case involving the untimely and tragic death of Mrs. Ethel Galding. There is no question about what caused her death. She died of a disease called malignant mesothelioma, which is a cancer of the lining of the lung invariably associated with exposure to significant quantities of asbestos dust. Mrs. Galding's exposure to asbestos dust occurred in 1956. She was exposed to asbestos board, which was used by her husband to build a vanity cabinet in her bedroom. And one characteristic of mesothelioma is that it takes generally 25 to 30 years to develop an injury, develop a disease. From the date of exposure to asbestos, and this was no exception to Mrs. Galding's case, she developed the mesothelioma in 1983 and died in 1984. So the scientific proof in the case indicates that that Mrs. Galding's mesothelioma, fatal cancer, can be attributed to this exposure to asbestos board in 1956. Her survivors tried to identify who made the asbestos board that caused this injury. There were no labels, no markings on the asbestos board that caused the injury, so they were unable to identify the manufacturer that should be held responsible for the injury. So what they did was they sued all of the manufacturers of asbestos board that they knew of that were amenable to suit in Dallas County where the death occurred. And they attempted to try to identify the manufacturer of the board through discovery. This is a very unusual case in that they were actually able to obtain a piece of the board that caused the injury. It's unusual because these injuries are latent and occur many years after the exposure, but in this situation they knew the precise product that caused the injury and were able to obtain a sample of the board for chemical analysis. They had an expert perform chemical analysis and got a description of the chemical composition of the board, and compared the chemical composition of the board that they were able to find out with the answers to interrogatories of the defendants. And the answers to interrogatories revealed that the asbestos board could have been manufactured by any of the five defendants that were sued. Also, the plaintiff asked in discovery whether the defendants themselves knew of any way to distinguish whose board, asbestos board, this was. And the defendants responded that it was their understanding that without the packaging of the board, and because the board contained no marks identifying the manufacturer, they were unaware of any way to identify which company was actually manufacturing and sold the board that caused the injury. Finally, in an effort to identify the manufacturer of the board, the plaintiff produced the board to the defendants themselves and said, you admit or deny whether or not you made the board based on your visual inspection of the board and a chemical analysis, and none of the defendants were able to admit or deny that they had made the asbestos board. Because of this inability, which plaintiffs believe they are not accountable for, but is the result of identical manufacture of a generic product and marketing a product without sufficient labeling, they were forced to ask the trial court to shift the burden of proof in this case from the plaintiffs to the defendants to establish the manufacturer of the board.
Was there evidence in the record of all the people that manufactured this product and the percentage of the market that they shared in?
There was no evidence of the percentages of the market. In response to the discovery request, the defendants, several of the defendants identified their competitors and they identified the other defendants in the action with the addition of a company called Johns Manville, and which was not a party to the suit because Johns Manville was embroiled in bankruptcy proceedings. But there was no specific evidence on how much of the market.
Are you asking us to fashion a Sindel type remedy?
Yes, we are asking the court to shift the burden of proof in this case. We have identified a number of alternative theories that the court could avail itself of, and one of them is the Sindel type of market share theory.
How can we adopt a Sindel type remedy if we don't know what percentage of the market this particular defendant shares?
Well, we believe that the burden under Sindel is on the defendants to establish what percentage of the market they are responsible for. They were certainly aware of our theory. It was pleaded in all of the petitions that were filed, and we contended it throughout. Additionally, upon remand, the court, the parties can avail themselves of the procedures to identify and establish the market share. In any event, the plaintiffs resorted to this the request to shift the burden of proof under these extraordinary circumstances only after it became obvious that the task of identifying which precise company manufactured the product was impossible. And the record firmly demonstrates this. In the trial court and the Court of Appeals, the
Catherine, before you proceed, do you admit that you have not sued all possible tort cases?
Yes. I
do admit that.
Yes, I do admit that because of the presence of Johns Manville, which is a company that we believe made asbestos board similar to the type that these defendants manufacture. However, Johns Manville is not amenable to suit because they have been embroiled in bankruptcy proceedings and were at the time of Mrs. Galding's death and were at the time that summary judgment was granted in defendant's favor in this case.
So you're saying that you sued everybody except Manville and nobody else, the possible tortfeasor?
Well, there may be other possible tortfeasors, but we think the likelihood of them actually being involved in Mrs. Galding's injury is very unlikely. There was an amicus brief filed by 131 political subdivisions of the state in support of our position, and there, as defendants point out in their brief, there were hundreds of manufacturers of asbestos board products, but it serves no purpose as far as the amici are concerned, as far as we're concerned, to sue companies that really, as a practical matter, could not be expected to have a connection with the injury. We sued all of the manufacturers of asbestos board that we knew of that could be sued in Dallas County, and we're saying that's enough. There certainly are theoretical possibilities that we didn't name every single one that ever existed in the United States, but it is our belief that we sued the vast majority. And as the pleadings point out, we claim that the companies that were sued so dominated the market that it would serve no purpose to sue anyone else. In the trial court and in the Court of Appeals, relied on Texas precedent for burden shifting, as well as the various theories of collective liability that have been crafted by other jurisdictions in trying to solve a problem of identification. The case of Landers versus East Texas Saltwater Disposal Company was the first example that we cited of a situation in which the traditional burden of proof on the plaintiff was shifted by the court to relieve an unfair situation. In Landers, prior to Landers, a plaintiff had the burden of establishing which portion of his injury was related to each defendant. And if he was unable to carry that burden, he could not recover. That was the law before Landers. When this court took the case, they realized that rule was patently unfair in cases of indivisible injury where a number of companies combine to cause an injury and the plaintiff can't tell which one is responsible for which portion of his injury. So the court changed the rule and shifted the burden of proof to the defendants to allocate among themselves which portion of the injury they are responsible for, and if they can't do that, then they are jointly and severally liable for the injury.
How do you respond to the argument made by respondents that Landers is not controlling here and is distinguishable, that in that Landers both joint tortfeasors, there was proof that they contributed to the injury, and here there is no proof that these five defendants have contributed to the injury, so that's distinguishable. They make that argument. What is your response?
I agree that the case is distinguishable. I agree that the holding in Landers is not precisely applicable to the holding here. I cite Landers as an example of a situation where a previous law had a burden of proof on the plaintiff, and the court recognized the patent unfairness of that rule, recognized that the burden of proof would more appropriately be shifted to defendants on this issue. Prior to Landers, I'm sure in the Landers argument, the defense lawyer said that there's no precedent for this in Texas. It's unfair to shift the traditional burden of proof to us because it's plaintiff's burden to establish by preponderance of the evidence which portion of the injury I caused. If he can't establish that, he hasn't carried his burden. And the court said, well, that's no impediment here because it's unfair. Again, I'm not saying that Landers is a precisely similar fact situation. I'm just using it as an example where the court felt that the shifting in the burden of proof was appropriate.
So you're asking this court to shift the burden of proof in these type of circumstances, even if there's no proof that the defendant have contributed to the injury?
There is no proof that they manufactured the product that caused the injury, yes. All of these defendants, accepting the plaintiff's pleadings as true, which this court must, were negligent and their products were defectively designed for purposes of the summary judgment motion that the defendants filed. All of them were wrongdoers. All of them combined to market these were parties to parallel marketing of unidentifiable products. And so in that respect, I think that all defendants contributed, maybe not to the injury, but to the inability of the plaintiff to identify which of the companies caused the injury. But yes, it is. This certainly is a situation that this court has not confronted before. In Landers, the court did hold that the shift in the burden of proof was appropriate. And felt that the inability to apportion injuries when it was the defendant, at least one of the defendants or a group of defendants that caused the injuries in the first place, would more appropriately be visited on the defendants than the plaintiffs. In Duncan versus Cessner, many years later, the court adopted a theory of comparative causation in products liability cases. The court judicially adopted this theory. And nevertheless, despite the fact that the court felt that injuries or damages should be allocated according to the percentage of responsibility that each defendant had, retained the rule of joint and several liability in products liability cases, and retained it even though it understood expressly that it would mean that if there was an insolvent defendant, a company may have to pay more than its share of damages that it caused. The court recognized a number of policy reasons for this, which we feel are applicable in this case as well. Of course, the most obvious one is the products liability theory of compensating plaintiffs injured by defective products, but also balanced the burden of a failure or a lack of proof against a negligent or guilty party or a party that markets a defective product as opposed to an innocent or even just a partially innocent plaintiff, because the Duncan joint and several liability applies even when the plaintiff is found to some degree negligent.
But in Duncan, it speaks to the situation where you know that all the defendants are liable in some degree.
Yes, Your Honor, that's true.
Here we don't know which defendants are liable, do we?
We don't know which defendants manufactured the product that caused the injury. That's correct.
Or does that make a difference to you?
It makes a difference in the sense that the situations aren't exactly. I can't argue that Duncan compels the result in this case. But I think that, again, in light of the parallel marketing practices of the defendant and the plaintiff's utter inability, after trying and after obtaining the product, to get the defendants to identify which company marketed the product, I think the shift in the burden is appropriate.
Well, what you're asking is, are there any states other than New Jersey and California that have recognized this market sharing concept?
Yes, the Wisconsin Supreme Court recognized it in Collins, and the Washington Supreme Court recognized it in Martin versus Abbott Laboratories. Under pure Sindel theory, provided the plaintiff joins a substantial share of the market, the defendants would be jointly and severally liable for all of the plaintiff's damages, and unless the defendant could exculpate itself or unless it could show that its damages would be limited to a particular market share. Under the Martin theory, the court dispensed with joint and several liability in market share cases and held that defendants could only be liable to the extent of their market share and that it was not a matter of contribution among the defendants. But it dispensed with the rule of joint and several liability that the Sindel court apparently was willing to keep. But there are variations of the theory in many different courts. Another way to, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Before you go on, California and Washington have adopted market sharing in regard, in those cases involved medical, pharmaceutical laboratories, didn't they not? Drugs.
Yes, they did.
What about New Jersey and Wisconsin? What was the product there?
In both of those cases, they were pharmaceutical products. One was a DES case, and one, I believe, was a DPT vaccine. The case in New Jersey that I'm referring to is the Shackle case, which was an intermediate New Jersey appellate court. The defendants and the amicus curiae, whose brief I received on Friday, tried to distinguish the DES cases, the pharmaceutical cases, from this case, because they say that in the DES cases there were certain circumstances that aren't presented in this case. And to support that, they cite several Supreme Court cases from other states where the theory of market share liability was held inapplicable. The reason why they say that the theory of market share liability will not serve to shift the burden of proof in this case is because they say that in the DES cases, the pharmaceutical cases, the products were fungible, that is, they were identical, whereas in asbestos cases, generally, the products are of different types. There are different types of asbestos insulation products that liability is sought to be imposed for. Also, they say that in the DES cases, there is a so-called signature injury, that is an injury that is almost always related to that particular pharmaceutical product, so that ensures reliability, that it's not unfair to hold these manufacturers accountable for these injuries, because we know to a certainty that it was at least caused by the type of product that the defendant manufactured. We submit that this case, this particular asbestos case, is indistinguishable in those respects from a DES case. It's true that in the case the Court of Appeals cited out of Oklahoma, and the Goldman case and the Copeland case and the other cases in which market share liability was held not to apply, there were a variety of asbestos products at issue. But in this case, as is very obvious, there is only one product. Not only one type of product, but one product, the asbestos board. And that element, and because all of the defendants manufactured a product of that, exactly of that type, the fungibility element of the Sindel case is present here. Also, this case involves a signature injury, just like the Sindel case. Mesothelioma is a signature injury. It's, again, a cancer of the lining of the lung invariably associated with asbestos. And there's proof in the record in this of this fact, as well as an affidavit by one of the plaintiff's expert witnesses, as well as it's recognized in many judicial opinions in asbestos litigation. So both of the critical elements of Sindel that the defendants themselves say are critical are satisfied in this case.
Mr. Rosenthal, what evidence in the record shows that each defendant made the board identical to the one found in the Golden House?
Well, the plaintiffs propounded interrogatories asking the defendants to identify their asbestos board products and to describe the products. And each of the defendants responded that gave a description of the board products that it made. And although the descriptions of the products varied even within the set of answers to interrogatories itself. Each company manufactured a type of product that could be included. And again,
a type of product is different from an identical product.
Well, no, each company, for instance, and without being exact about it, one of the companies identified making an asbestos board containing varying of asbestos from between 20% to 75%. The plaintiff's asbestos board contained 36% of asbestos, 36% asbestos. So the answers to interrogatories established that the defendant's product was of the type the product that the plaintiff was exposed to.
Is there any other evidence other than the answer to interrogatory that you mentioned?
Interrogatories also say that they believe that the products were indistinguishable except for the packaging, and they were unable to deny that they manufactured the product when it was produced to them. So that evidence indicates that the defendants cannot exculpate themselves and cannot say that they didn't manufacture a product like that.
And respect to this particular fiberboard, you said it had a 36% asbestos content.
Yes.
Is there anything in the record in respect to evidence that, let's take hypothetically Celotex, since it's one of the ones here.
Yes.
That there is no consistency in the manufacture of fiber boards as to the content of asbestos. It's from board to board. It might vary lower than 36% and go higher than 36%, or would all boards manufactured by one company contain the same amount of asbestos in each board?
The answers to interrogatories, which is the only discovery in the record on this, is unclear on that point. But the defendants had the opportunity to deny, to say this asbestos board is not consistent with our formula, and they didn't do so. So I guess the inference from that is that the manufacturer of asbestos board would encompass varying degrees of asbestos fiber included in the board, but it was simply not enough information for them to admit or deny that they made the board. Again, taking the defendants at their word, it appears that by analyzing the chemical composition of the board, it's not enough to include or exclude any one of them as being the manufacturer of the board. Another reason why we contend that Texas law favors the shift of the burden of proof in a case of this type is the maintenance of the rule of joint and several liability by the Texas legislature in the recent tort reform legislation. The civil code, the Texas legislature abolished joint and several liability in cases where a plaintiff could not show that a defendant was at least 20% responsible or 10% responsible if the plaintiff himself was comparatively negligent, but expressly retained the rule in toxic tort cases. We feel that this indicates a legislative recognition that toxic tort cases are different than products liability cases in general, because they generally, chemically induced injuries involve a latency period, passage of time, making it difficult for a plaintiff to identify the manufacturer of the product.
Does the same act say, however, there is no, they do not create a cause of action for toxic tort?
Yes, Your Honor, that is contained in the act. But we feel that, I think that it's obvious that provision, when directed towards the toxic tort portion, indicates that there's no absolute liability, that there's still, the plaintiff still needs to prove that the defendant tortiously marketed the product, either negligently or that the product was defective. And there is not an absolute liability just because one encounters a chemical substance. In our case, we the pleadings establish, and again, must be taken as true on the liability point, and that is that the defendants marketed this asbestos board knowing that it had the propensity to cause harm and yet failing to warn and failing to adjust the product to make it safe. And we're not seeking to impose absolute liability on an industry. We have to show that the defendants are liable either under theories of negligence or strict liability. It's not a question of us trying to impose liability on innocent companies. All of these companies tortiously marketed the product. The problem is that because the product is fungible, the plaintiff is simply unable to show which one is responsible for the product, and we think that this problem of identification should be visited on the companies that made the product and marketed them identically than on the plaintiff himself, who's innocent of that. In the defendant's response brief, arguing that policy reasons militate against the shift of the burden of proof that the plaintiffs in this case advocate, they contend that this is an unprecedented expansion of liability, and to the extent that it's unprecedented, I agree, but I don't agree that it's the dramatic expansion of liability for manufacturers that they paint in their brief. Again, we are seeking to impose liability only on manufacturers of defective products, manufacturers who marketed their products negligently, and where the injury can definitely be attributed to the type of product that the defendant marketed.
Well, are you saying that at the time the product was marketed, that it was common knowledge that this was a dangerous, hazardous product?
That's alleged in our petition, and we have proven it before in cases, and we will prove it in this case. We, in fact, allege gross negligence on the part of the manufacturers, that the information was available that asbestos was
at the time was it hazardous. Was marketed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
What, that it would generally cause disease, or it would cause this specific, what was it, melanoma of the lung lining?
Mesothelioma of the lining of the lung, yes. We allege that there was specific evidence that asbestos exposure could cause mesothelioma. And again, without getting in detail into the liability evidence, there was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1949 discussing this risk, and we feel like the defendants were on knowledge of that. There is also evidence that these defendants were members of trade associations where the hazards of asbestos were discussed, and again, elected not to warn consumers. But that is our burden still under this theory to show that, and if we can't show that, we can't hold the defendants liable. I noticed with surprise an argument in the amicus brief, which was filed on Friday, that said that this theory of liability that we advocate would seek to impose would discourage the manufacturer of safe products because it would apply liability across the board, and I simply can't fathom that argument in light of the position that we've taken throughout this case. The only manufacturers that could be held liable under this theory are manufacturers of a defective product or manufacturers who negligently marketed the product, not manufacturers of the product. If their product was safer, they wouldn't be included in the group that we've sued. So, and unless we can show that the injury was attributable to a defect in the product, which was the fact that the products contained asbestos, or the fact that the products were labeled improperly, we can't recover. And we can establish those things, and the inability to link the injury to a particular tortfeasor rather than a class of tortfeasor should not be fatal in the case.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. We are ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court. My name is Kevin Cook. I represent the respondents in this appeal, who were the defendants in the court below. I think it's important for the court to understand how this case arose, because I know some of your questions regard the liability issues in regard whether or not the decedent's injury was caused by asbestos-containing products. Those simply were not an issue in the summary judgment on the court below. And the reason is this. The starting point should be simply Texas law on causation, which is clear. A plaintiff must prove that the defendant made or distributed the product which caused the plaintiff's injury. In this case, the plaintiff admitted that they were unable to identify the asbestos product at issue, its manufacturer, and therefore were unable to identify the manufacturer that made or distributed the product. Based on their admitted failure to carry the burden of proof on causation, the district court granted defendant summary judgment. Whether or not these products are defective, whether or not mesothelioma was caused by these products simply was not placed at issue because there was no necessity to do so. What the plaintiff in this case is asking you to do is simply to change the Texas law on causation. What they want you to do is to adopt a theory that would allow them to take a selected few defendants of more than 300 different manufacturers and hold them liable without any proof that the decedent was exposed to a product made or distributed by any of those defendants. Now, what the petitioners do is they give you four different theories and they kind of just jumble them together. I think it's important for the court to go through each of the four different theories and look at their requirements. And when that's done, the fact situation in this case does not fall under any of the four theories they're asking the court to use. The first theory is the market share liability theory, which comes from the California Sindel case. That case involved the synthetic drug DES. The market share liability theory has never been applied outside of the pharmaceutical industry, and in fact has been rejected repeatedly when applied to asbestos cases, including rejected in California, the state that created the theory. The market share liability...
Are you saying the California Supreme Court has now overturned?
No. The California Appeals Level Court, in a case I think it would be similar to the situation that the 130 political subdivisions which filed an amicus brief are in, which are property damage cases, have said that the market share liability theory of Sindel will not work under that situation and that those plaintiffs cannot use the market share liability theory in asbestos.
Oh, the California Intermediate Court specifically wrote on asbestos.
Yes, sir, in the Mullen case, which is cited in our brief.
Has that gone up to the Supreme Court yet?
I don't believe so. I don't know, to be honest with you. The market share liability theory has two basic requirements. One is a completely fungible product made from an identical formula and that causes a singular risk of harm. Second requirement is you have to have an identifiable and quantifiable market for you to figure out the market share responsibility of each of the different defendants. And neither of those requirements are met here. The asbestos board in question is not a fungible product. And while the plaintiff says that the defendants have admitted that each of these different products are board products are identical.
Excuse me, I hate to interrupt you here. Tell me again that California CA case. Mullen, is that what
it's the Mullen case, Judge. Mullen versus Armstrong World Industries.
Thank you.
I can give you a cite on that, Judge.
That's all right. It's in the brief, you say.
If I don't accomplish anything else today, what I need to make clear to you is that the interrogatory answers and responses to requests for admissions that the plaintiff is relying on do not establish that all asbestos board products are identical. For instance, you have five different interrogatory answers to five different defendants and they say five different things. For example, GAF says that you can't visually distinguish these products. They look alike, but doesn't mention whether or not the products are chemically identical. National Gypsum indicates that it may be possible to distinguish some of asbestos board products, and Keene says we never made asbestos board product. We have no idea, we don't have the information as to whether or not you can distinguish other manufacturers' products, but as far as we're concerned, we didn't make one. With regard to the request for admissions, what the plaintiff did was sent requests for admissions saying, admit that you are unable to chemically to identify these products through chemical analysis. And simply what happened is the defendants responded, we are unable to admit or deny the request for admission. And now what they're wanting the court to do is take an answer to a request for admission that was not an admission and try and use it as one. And I don't think that that's appropriate. Simply the problem is the manufacturers can't distinguish this product from products of 300 other manufacturers because they don't have the product information of the 300 other manufacturers. What the transcript before the court in reality shows is that these few defendants alone made more than a dozen different types of asbestos board products, varying in asbestos content from 18% to 97%. Some manufacturers made several different types of products, varying in content from what the same type of range. I believe Celotex was from 22% to 95%. And what this does, because of this, the fungibility requirement of the Sindel case fails. And the reason is this. The asbestos products do not create a singular risk of harm like DES did. All DES was identical. It created the same risk of harm. Asbestos products are different. For one, asbestos itself is not a product. It's a natural mineral. There are six different types of asbestos fibers, more than 3,000 different types of asbestos products, and each product carries its own risk of harm depending on the type of fiber used, the percentage of asbestos in the product, and the type of product itself. The asbestos board product is not going to produce the type of dust that a cement is going to produce when you mix cement. And because each different product creates its own different risk of harm, the cases have repeatedly rejected the application of the market share liability theory in asbestos cases. There's a second problem in addition to asbestos products not being fungible when you want to apply the market share liability theory. And that is that...
Let me interrupt you again. I'm trying to diagram. You said there are four theories. Are we still under market share?
We're still under market share, Judge. I think that market share is probably the major theory that they're asking this court to adopt, and is the theory I'm going to spend the most time on. Okay. I think that the other ones aren't as complicated as market share and don't take as much time. The second part of the Sindel market share test is you have to be able to identify the market. The problem you have in asbestos case is because asbestos is not fungible, because it creates a different risk of harm, each different product, the market share responsibility of each defendant cannot be adjusted according to the alleged harmfulness of its product. While in DES, you could say, well, this manufacturer has 20% of the market and its product is identical to this manufacturer who has 10% of the market. You can adjust the responsibility of each of these defendants according to their market share. It doesn't work when you have an asbestos product and you have five different manufacturers, and not only does each have its market share of the overall asbestos board market, but each has a different product that creates a different potential risk of harm. And the cases that have looked at this problem have simply said the complications in determining the responsibility according to market share of each of the defendants cannot be determined. And the market share liability theory doesn't work. Now, in this case, the petitioner is saying, well, it's not so complicated here because instead of the cases like in these 130 political subdivisions where you have dozens of different products, which again also is going to create a problem where you have a plaintiff who's exposed to 20 products, then you have 20 different market share calculations that you're going to have to make and then relate it to one and determine overall liability when you have 20 different products. They're saying, well, here we just have an asbestos board. And there are several reasons why it doesn't work even for asbestos boards. One, of course, as I've gone over, you've got several different types. The percentage of asbestos in each maker's board varies dramatically. And in the Goldman case, which is out of Ohio, they dealt with one singular type of product, asbestos tape. And the fact that there were different types of asbestos tapes containing different levels of asbestos in that case alone was enough for the courts to say that the market share responsibility of each defendant couldn't be determined. But here, you also have other problems. One, your major manufacturers of asbestos products, such as John Mansfield, are bankrupt. And so, therefore, you can't get a substantial share of the market because you're not going to have all the players at the game.
You talk in the plural. Are there others?
Judge, the interrogatory answers indicate that in addition to John Mansfield, one defendant said most other major manufacturers of asbestos products made board products. Another identified at least two other companies, one being a Superdur company, another being certain teed products that are not defendants in the suit, but yet the record indicates made asbestos board products in addition to John Mansfield, which almost all of the defendants identify.
Are they amenable to process in Dallas court?
I'm trying to remember if I've seen...
Certainty certainly is.
Yeah,
we had a case
I've seen Certainty before.
Certainty.
I don't know about Superdur. You also have a problem in this case because of how the board was purchased. This board was purchased at a salvage yard by the husband of the decedent and was purchased 30 years ago. Well, you don't know, because it was purchased secondhand, you don't know where it was originally sold. You don't know whether it was originally sold in Texas or originally sold in some other state. You don't know whether it was originally sold in the year in which it was purchased by the husband of the decedent or originally sold in some other year. You don't know, have any idea, and nobody has any idea, how this product found its way from where it originally began to where it ended up. Every court that is...
Are you only conceding for purposes of summary judgment that this board was the agent which caused the mesothelioma? Or do you think, do you think they will be able to establish that at a trial on the merits?
That's simply a jury issue that they're going to have to carry the burden of proof on, Judge. We didn't have to create a fact issue on that issue in this case to prevail because of their admission that they could not carry the burden of proof on causation. Simply, there wasn't a reason to join that issue, but it will be joined if the case went to trial.
If this case went to trial, that would be an issue.
Yes, it would.
It's whether you can ever pinpoint causation on a disease like that to a particular exposure.
Not only that, Judge, but with regard to this disease, as I understand it, there are other causes of mesothelioma other than asbestos products. It's simply those other causes have not been identified. The way that's happened is simply there are people who have come down with the disease and it's there has not been any showing that those people ever came in contact with asbestos. So there are some...
I mean, if anybody's over 10 years old, they've come in contact with asbestos.
Well, I guess that's something that's subject to proof, but if it's in all the schools in the state, theoretically, then anyone who went to public school, certainly there's a possibility of exposure.
Well, anybody that comes and visits the Supreme Court building.
They won't even work on our air conditioning because to do so would mean cutting into the asbestos.
The other theories that the petitioners cited, for example, the concert of action theory. That theory is not a substitute.
What theory?
The concert of action theory. That is the classic case of that is the illegal drag race case, where you have an illegal drag race, one of the drivers of the drag race injures a bystander, and under that theory, not only can the bystander sue the driver, but the bystander can sue the other driver and can sue the flagman because of a common plan to commit a tortious act. The problem with the concert of action theory is it's not a substitute for causation. The first thing you have to do is identify a wrongdoer. And once you identify that wrongdoer, then parties attempt to use the concert of action theory to expand liability beyond the identified wrongdoer. But if you cannot identify who it is who supplied a product then it seems, then the courts have said you can't use the theory because you don't know if who identified the product acted in concert with anyone. Even the Sindel case, when discussing DES, rejected the concert of action theory as well as the other two theories that the plaintiffs are relying on, which is alternative liability and enterprise liability. Alternative liability is another California theory that is now in the restatement of torts. It comes from the Summers versus Type case, which is a case where you had two hunters firing simultaneously, plaintiff hit by one bullet, nobody knows who shot him. The problem with that theory in this case is, and the cases repeatedly say, you have to have all possible defendants as parties to the suit, so you know that one of these defendants is the one who did it. Well, in this case, that's the problem. Nobody knows whether or not one of these defendants is the one who supplied that asbestos board. The last theory that the plaintiff is asking you to consider is the enterprise liability theory. That is the New Jersey theory created in the Blasting Cap case. The Blasting Cap industry was an industry that was made up of primarily six manufacturers. They worked jointly with a trade association that established their safety, that established the warnings, and basically that trade association controlled the risk of harm. The cases that have addressed this enterprise liability theory in asbestos settings have unanimously rejected it for several reasons. One is, like the alternative liability theory, you have to have all of the defendants together in the lawsuit who supplied the product. The second problem is, and the case itself said, that creative theory said this only works when you have a very small group of manufacturers. And that's not present here. There are more than 300 manufacturers of asbestos products. In addition to the fact that if you go through each of the four theories, their requirements aren't met, there are policy considerations that weigh against some sort of collective liability theory.
We'll be able to go after one or two or three selected manufacturers and hold them responsible for the acts of an entire industry. The second policy reason I believe that this court should seriously consider is that these collective liability theories have been rejected in California, Florida, Ohio, Georgia, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, and Oklahoma. What's going to happen is that if these theories are adopted in Texas, these out-of-state plaintiffs are going to come to Texas and file suit against the manufacturers amenable to suit in Texas. And this already happens with regard to statute of limitations cases. You have plaintiffs who worked in Alabama and Virginia shipyards who come to Texas and file suit to get the benefit of the statute of limitations, because the statute of limitations in Texas is more generous to the plaintiffs than the statute of limitations in their other states.
Why don't they go to Mississippi, which I think has got the longest statute of limitations of any country?
Judge, I guess maybe they go to Mississippi as well, but the fact is I understand that in Dallas alone, our firm is defending more than 200 suits brought by Alabama and Virginia shipyard workers. Also, simply what this will do is it's going to cause the defendants that are amenable to suit in Texas to bear a larger responsibility for the overall tortious acts of an industry, because these are the only manufacturers that are going to be able, that these theories are going to work against. Finally, nearly all of the cases unanimously say this type of problem is a type of problem that's better suited for a legislative solution rather than a judicial solution. And I think because of all the different factors involved, the different problems in determining some type of liability on an industry-wide basis, if it's something that's going to be done, is better suited for the legislative arena than the judicial arena.
Well, this is a bothersome philosophical point. Certainly it's an area the legislature can speak to, and if they speak to it in a constitutional way, we should respect it. If it hasn't been spoken to, then we are squarely in the area of the common law. This court is responsible for developing. And
at least I see a, feel a sense of frustration and read enough of the literature to know that, virtually everybody else does in trying to fit all the problems of the 20th century into doctrines that were developed really for carriage accidents or for people inadvertently letting their wild animals escape or water or go from upstream to downstream. We have a very expensive and slow system of justice that we're now trying to accommodate to all the complexities of modern life, such as these types of tort cases. And if you really think we have to, we just sit and wait to see if the legislature chooses to act or not to act as far as reshaping the common law to fit some of these realities. Did I make any sense of that question?
Yes, you did. Yeah, I think that, frankly, that's the frustration the court had in Duncan when prior it, in its opinion, said, well, this is the type of situation the legislature should address because they've already addressed liability, comparative responsibility in the situation. Legislature didn't do it. The court came back with Duncan. But I think that the problem involved in this case is such a large problem that the type of record that you have before you here isn't the type of record that gives you enough information to develop a proper or total response to the problem. I think additionally the amicus briefs make it the argument that the judicial system, because of the expense and because of the time it takes to get a solution, isn't the proper arena to do it. And in fact, what if these theories are adopted in Texas, the result's going to be that system's going to become more complicated and it's going to become slower because more cases are going to be filed. You're going to have these out-of-state plaintiffs coming in filing cases. More defendants are going to be added to suits and things are going to slow down. They're not going to speed up. In this case also, what the plaintiff is trying to make one point, which is, well, what I want you to do is limit it to the peculiar facts of this case. Give the survivors of Ethel Galding a collective liability theory, but limit it to the unique facts here. And I just don't think that that's something that can be done for several reasons. One is, once the door gets opened a little bit, you're going to have other plaintiffs trying to get through the door and opening the door. And second, and I think it's obvious from the amicus brief filed by the 130 political subdivisions, there are a lot of other plaintiffs that want to use these theories beyond the facts that are presented in this case. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Briefly, in rebuttal, I'd first like to touch on a point that Chief Justice Phillips made, and that is the fact that these situations involving toxic torts were unforeseen by the courts in the at the times that the law was developing. For instance, on alternative liability in the Summers versus Tice case, the first case that I'm aware of where a burden of proof was shifted from the plaintiffs or defendants, that case was decided 40 years ago. The restatement that codified the rule in Summers versus Tice did specifically say that the shift of the burden of proof was appropriate where all possible tortfeasors were before the court. But the comment to the restatement provision, Section 433, says that the rule codified in the restatement is not supposed to be exclusive and that the drafters of the restatement recognize that different circumstances may arise necessitating an expansion or an adjustment of the rule announced in Summers. And I think that recognition of the facts of this case indicates that this case does present such a situation where the rule needs to be adjusted to adapt to the circumstances. The defendant's argument that Texas case law has as an essential element that the plaintiff must prove that the defendant made or distributed the product that caused the injury, was limited to cases where the issue of whether the defendant's product caused the injury was also a negligent act on the part of the defendant. The cases that they cite, what I call the bug in the bottle case, were cases where if the defendant was responsible for the product, then it was only the defendant that acted negligently. The other companies that were joined did not behave tortiously. Whereas in this case, we've got a uniform pattern of conduct, a uniform marketing of the product, and the situation is different. We're not attempting to impose liability on innocent manufacturers, only those who tortiously marketed the asbestos products.
Counsel, let me ask you a question here. If I understand the thrust of your opponent's argument, in each of these theories, it's okay if you don't know exactly who did it, providing you have everybody in court that could have done it. And then let the jury sort it out or make an allocation. Whereas they're saying in your case, we don't know who did it and you don't have everybody that could have done it. I'm not quite sure if that's feasible in today's modern society when you don't have jurisdiction over some, or as I understand it, one of the parties is in receivership?
Bankruptcy, yes.
I recognize that to be a problem, but that aside, just address the philosophical idea that in all these theories, it seems like that you have to join as a party defendant everybody that had something to do with it or could have had something to do with it or make that product, as the case may be, and then let the jury sort it out.
Well, to respond to that first, I would point out under the market share theory, the Sindel theory, there were parties or manufacturers there that were not joined, and that didn't deter the court from saying the burden of proof shifts to the defendants. Secondly, if there are a number of manufacturers, as there are here, we've got to admit that the chances of if one company actually manufactured the product, whether the company that actually did it is joined or not, the chances are that the liability is going to be imposed on a company that did not manufacture the precise product. If we had joined all 300 companies, then according to the defendants, the criteria would be satisfied, but I don't see how that really increases the fairness to the innocent defendants that have to share the burden. When I say innocent defendants, I mean the parties that did not happen to manufacture the product that the plaintiff encountered. So I don't see why the requirement that all parties be joined would increase the fairness to the defendants. Am I responding to the court's question?
Let's go to Mullins. Why did the California Court of Appeals refuse to extend Sindel from DES to asbestos?
Because in Mullins, the products at issue were a wide variety of asbestos products, a wide variety of types of products. As counsel mentioned, cement is different from pipe covering, which is different from block, which is different from asbestos board, which is different from tape. These products contain different types of asbestos, different amounts of asbestos, different amounts of other substances. In our case, we've got one product, and the fact that each defendant is unable to deny that it manufactured a product precisely like this product of an identical formula means that we are dealing with a fungible product here. We're not dealing with a wide variety of products. And I understand that our argument would distinguish the situation of the 131 political subdivisions, that because they are dealing with a variety of products and arguing that market share be applied. But that is a distinguishing fact in this case. The product truly, it couldn't be more fair. We've actually got the product itself that caused the injury. So we're not dealing with a situation of fungible products here.
Let me ask another question that can't be answered. How does a court, sitting here with more briefs than we usually have and with an hour and 15 minutes worth of argument, fashion a remedy of such sweeping proportions that's fair and that we can accurately predict the effect of? We know that if we come up with any kind of enterprise liability, no matter how limited, that's going to be a shifting of resources from certain companies and insurance companies and then eventually from the people at large to other people. it may have wide societal effects, that is, make companies much less likely to compete in a field. If a drug company decides to start manufacturing a competing drug and try to capture 1% of the market, they can theoretically end up with 100% of the liability 5 years from now if that drug turns out to have some dangerous side effects. How do we go about gathering enough information to create a fair and workable rule? That is, how do we see the effects of our ruling?
I will try to provide a non-answer to that question. I think that it certainly is true that that the court won't be able to predict the effect of this. I think that some of the parade of horribles that are presented by the amicus curiae and by defendants are greatly exaggerated. That is, I think that that the threat to the insurance industry is, I don't really understand it. While it does involve, to some degree, an expansion of liability, since the market share theory would allocate liability according to the percentage of market share, it makes it more predictable, not less. In a typical case...
But you want unlimited joint and several liabilities.
Well, that's my first argument, yes. And placing on defendants the burden to bring in the companies that the other companies that manufactured the identical products. They could have joined CertainT just like we could have sued them if we'd known.
If John Manville is bankrupt and they had 40% of the market share, would you be willing to limit the joint liability percent of the company?
Well, if that's the condition placed on a ruling in my favor, I'd certainly agree to that. But you'd rather
have assessed that.
Yes, Your Honor, and again, in Duncan versus Cessna, the same fact situation exists, or the same problem exists, whether the plaintiff can identify the products or not. Under Duncan versus Cessna, the liability of the insolvent defendant is placed on all the other manufacturers, even if you can prove that the plaintiff was exposed to 40% Johns Manville material. So the same shifting of resources exists under Duncan as exists in this case.
You're asking essentially that the risk be spread even if an imprecise manner. That is, you don't know exactly who did it, but spread the risk and don't put the whole loss on the plaintiff. Is that basically what you're saying?
In a sense, yes. We are asking that the risk, instead of being borne by the innocent plaintiff, be borne by the companies that manufactured identically the product, or a product of the type. I think, again, the idea that Texas courts would be inundated by suits from other jurisdictions would be answered by the court's opinion in Gutierrez versus Collins involving a choice of substantive law. The statute of limitations issue, statute of limitations of repeatedly been held by this court to be procedural and not a substantive right, so that accounts for plaintiffs in states where their actions are barred by some draconian rule of statute of limitations can file suit here. But substantive choice of law is limited by Gutierrez versus Collins, so I don't believe that an action that has a connection to another state would avail itself of Texas law. And again, as I pointed out, the other jurisdictions have not rejected a collective liability theory in the context that I'm talking about, that this case presents, only in a case where there are a wide variety of products with a wide variety of risk factors. I noted also a policy reason that was expressed for rejecting the theory was that it would encourage plaintiffs not to identify manufacturers of products and try to have liability imposed on all the industry rather than identify a particular manufacturer. I think it's, first of all, the flip side of the argument is that it would encourage manufacturers to label their products more distinctly and would not allow them to hide behind a fortress of fungibility, as we say in our brief, in order to avoid liability. It would encourage them to distinguish the products. It would encourage them to be accountable for the products that they manufacture that could injure people. Also, as it is now, if a plaintiff can identify you know, we're depending in products liability cases, toxic tort cases, and asbestos cases, on the ability, the recollection of a plaintiff 30 years ago, about which product he was exposed to 30 years ago. The Hardy opinion, which Judge Parker wrote a couple of years ago, explains that this is, while this is the way that a plaintiff must prove a case under traditional theories, it's unreliable. It's certainly more reliable to have the risk spread among all the manufacturers that could have made the product than to impose it on the single one that the plaintiff happens to be able to recall if he was exposed to others but couldn't recall who he was exposed to. So it's a more equitable system, a much more equitable system of allocating the loss. The bottom line is that under these circumstances, the burden of proof is more appropriately placed on the defendants that marketed, cautiously marketed the products than on the plaintiff himself. And for that reason, we ask that the court reverse the judgment of the Court of Civil Appeals and remand this case for development on the market share theory or any other of the collective liability theories that we allege in our briefs.
Would you settle if we just reverse the case of the court of the opinion of the Court of Appeals?
We'd like the opportunity to proceed
it
with that theory.
It hadn't been civil appeals for the last 7 years.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll satisfy. I'll be impressed by that. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. That completes the argument in the first case. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.